Like, oh, good, this is the person we have great confidence in. She's like a total space cadet now. I'm on Vermont time, not New York City. Bedtime. Time to go watch the grass grow in Vermont. We love that maple syrup. It makes us all very sweet. Even my dog, he licks my... Yes, he likes the snow. We do. We love to ski, and we love to ski. Okay, so did you have a long enough break yet? Are all the cookies gone? Do you have good cookies on my behalf? I had one. All right, so now I'm getting, we're going to go to another topic. And this is about, actually probably something nobody's really interested in, using any framework in web applications or services. Probably nobody really cares about that, right? So we could skip it? No. Okay. Yeah, this is really important. And who was using .NET 3.5 and trying to write services and trying to write disconnected applications and websites and web forms? Wow. And you all look relatively sane still. I'm impressed. It was pretty hard stuff. There was some issues about how the context works and how Entity Framework is designed that didn't make it extremely friendly for moving data across, data went across the wire fine. The problem was all of that great stuff that the context keeps track of for us, That's where the problem is. So whenever we're in websites and services is a problem. So there's a lot of help in Entity Framework 4, and we've looked at a lot of things that are actually going to come into play, and I'm going to, as a matter of fact, Steve showed a bunch of them this morning, and we're going to take a look at how these come together and some of the things you should be considering and taking advantage of from Entity Framework 4 when you're writing server-side applications, web apps, whether, you know, web forms, MVC, services, WCS services, whatever. So we're going to take a look at that. So moving across services, now we've talked a lot about the context today and about the object state entries, right? Those are all that state information that the context keeps track of. So the object context is managing your entities, and it's keeping track of all of that state information in the entities. And here's a big problem. Say you're writing using a web service, for example, and you've sent your entities down the wire to a client. The client's working on those entities and then sends those entities back up to the service for an update to the database. So here's what happens. The entities get serialized, they go across the wire, they get to the other side. The object context that it came from said, oh, I'm no longer managing those entities. I don't need the object state entries anymore. They're gone, right? The object state entry information did not get serialized and go across the wire with the entities, so they don't know anything about what their original properties were or what their entity state is, right? Big problem. Big problem because we're used to designing our applications in a certain way, especially if we're coming from the data set world. How many people here, like me, were coming from the data set world and it just all worked, right? We had these big, fat data sets and they had all their information in them and they all went across the wire, and we could just do whatever we wanted on the other side, even if Scott Hanselman was going, no, don't serialize data sets, we know. But, you know, it sure made it easy, especially when you own both ends of the wire. So a lot of people are very dependent on that, and then it just, like, all of a sudden didn't work, right, the way we expected it, and we had a lot of challenges. Now, there's plenty of people who are already designing their applications in a way that this really wasn't anything new. But really, a lot of people had this expectation. So all the change tracking information is gone, and we can't even go back and get it anymore because, you know, we've gotten rid of the object context, right? All that state information is gone, and the context doesn't come across the wire either. It's not serializable. There's why not make it serializable? It's a very good question, and that's what we all say. Well, why can't we serialize that stuff? And it's not the context that we need. It's the object state entries. That's all the information. So, you know, the reality of what's happening is, you know, the context is keeping track of that stuff, and it's the context that owns that information. The classes don't. So when we move the classes, see, we have in our application, our client-side application, we're using an object context, and we're doing all of that work, and it's keeping track of all the changes. And we go over to, the context doesn't get serialized. We go over to the other side. We create a new context and then attach the entities. Remember these entities that came across the wire. Remember when I was saying before that original information is not what it was when it came out of the database, but what it was the moment that you first attached it. So when it came across the wire, regardless of what it used to be, when I attach it on the server side in the service, all that object context says, oh, some entities, cool, okay, now I know what the original properties are, and if you want to make any changes, let me know, and I'll keep track of that. But it's starting from there, starting from zero. The object context and state entries are not getting serialized because the entity framework team, at least this is what they were saying a bunch of years ago, and even, you know, I was even screaming going, I can't write services. And they said it's too fat, right? We were making them streamlined. But the problem was they didn't give us tools to make up for that behavior. So for me, I'm okay without serializing all that garbage. I mean, it's not garbage. It's important information. But it's really a lot of information. So rather than serializing it, bringing it all across, and when I'm writing services, I don't necessarily want all that happening on the client side anyway, because that means now I'm forcing my clients to use Entity Framework in their client applications to work with my services, and maybe I don't want to do that anyway. So what I can do now, rather than bringing the context across from the state entries, is, we'll get there. So this is one of the big problems. We lose all that information when we go across the wire because it's not serialized, period. Here's another problem that's kind of related, all right? For a web forms application, all right? This is, you know, like people who write MVC, they don't care about this stuff. But web forms applications, they give us all this state, and we expect that state to be there, right? And they give us all these ways to kind of maintain state across postbacks, for example, and on the server side. So not everybody's familiar exactly how web forms works internally in the page request, but what happens is when you make a request to your ASP.NET web application, and you've got your server-side code, right? So the browser makes a request to the server. The server instantiates a new page object class, or an instance of the class. And then if we have Entity Framework code in there, that class internally will have code that instantiates a brand new object context. And then you have some queries in there, and through the object context and Entity Framework, it does a query, it creates some objects, and then it takes the data in that it's getting back, and it builds up your HTML, whatever, it's text boxes or drop-down lists or whatever, right? Takes the HTML, sends it back to the browser, and then gets rid of the page object and everything that the page object called. So now your object context that knew about the, that was managing those entities no longer exists, right? And all you have left is HTML. You get some markup. You don't really have. You can use session state and view state and all of that to start, you know, persisting your all your objects. You know, this is all the stuff that WebForms is doing for you. There's a lot of problems with doing that with Entity Framework and classes and scalability and all that, and I actually spent pages and pages and pages kind of going, you know, the pros and cons of all of these choices. So I don't really, in the book that I wrote, so I don't really want to go through all of that, but there is a lot of complexities there, okay? So this is the essence of the problem. And then I might do a post-back, right? And a post-back, I may think I'm using, you know, the same everything in my classes, but really on the post-back, it all starts over again. I create a new page class. The page class creates a brand new object context, right? So if you're looking at, for example, the WPF code that Rachel wrote this morning, you could create an object that you didn't have to write this morning. You could create, you know, in a Windows Forms app or a WPF or a console app, you can create an object context and leave it hanging around for the whole lifetime of that client application, right? Because they're all in the same place. No problem. You can go back and forth. So if you try to write that same kind of code in the code bind of a web forms, right, you create an object context, you do a query, right, and then you have a post back, and you know, somebody clicks a button and calls save, and you go object context.save. That object context doesn't have, you just created a brand new object context when you hit the post back. It created a brand new object context, so it has nothing to save. It doesn't know anything about those objects it queried before. So it's brand new every single time. Brand new object context, brand new page class, brand new markup. So we don't have that benefit of a long-running context that will just keep track of everything like you do on the client side. All right, so on the server side, you're constantly having to deal with a new context. And, you know, there are people who say, well, what about creating a context in my in the session cache for each user session? So a lot of problems that can come up with doing that. Well, what about instantiating a context in the global ASAX and using it for everybody? Now that's, you know, it sounds logical, but if you start thinking about, okay, so now I've got 400 people using the same context, and one of those, they're all online at the same time, and one of those persons says save. Right? What's going to happen? All 400 people's everything will get saved because they're all sharing a context, right? So you can't really do that either. So there's all, you know, like the what about this, what about that, what about that, what about that, what about that? There's just all kinds of reasons why so many of these ideas just aren't going to work. And we spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to come up with architectures. So we've got a lot of options in Entity Framework, in 3.5 and in 4. And I have this silly little chart here to kind of show, and this is right so far looking at just ASP.NET type applications. So this chart shows kind of like ease of development over, you know, like we've got the developer and we've got the architect. The developer is like, yeah, dynamic data entities, push a button. I don't even have to write a line of code. I just have to edit, you know, two words in a line of code, and then I'm done, right? Or Entity Data Source, which is a little more work, but it's still you're doing most all the stuff is defined in the markup, essentially, right? And you don't really have any control at all about how your queries are being executed, you know, et cetera. It's just all done in there. But it's really easy for developers. It's great, great, great. We love it. You know, and then we get into things that are a little more architecturally sound. Object data source is a funny thing. Object data source, you're doing some of the stuff in the UI, but essentially you are using a repository. So the UI just says, use this class, this repository class, and when the user requests an insert, use this method in my repository to do insert. When the user wants an update, use this method in the update. The problem for me with object data source, and I just want to make sure I'm clear in the fact that when I wrote the first edition of the book, that's what I used. I just said I'd have to write an extra 800 pages to come up with some crazy clever way of doing this in a better architectural way because we didn't have the tools, right? I chose the object data source. It seemed like the it gave me a nice middle ground of, you know, kind of architecturally kind of okay, you know, and not too nightmarish for me as a developer to try to figure out. So I did use the object data source. But the problem is when you do use the object data source, that control, the object data source is a control on your in your markup, and it has pointers to your class and to your methods that you want to use. So you do have separation there. But the problem is that control defines how you architect your program, how you architect your application. There's a lot of things I don't like about how that works. So I, like I said, it was the best I could come up with for a solution back then that was, you know, somewhat architecturally sound because I was getting separation and I wasn't really defining my queries in my markup, right? But I didn't like how it enforced me to design my repository its way instead of however I wanted to define it. Does anybody here even use the object data source? Two people. Okay, so I'm not going to dwell on that too much. There's also MVC, which is now, you know, part of .NET and part of the ASP.NET stack. MVC doesn't care about session state, right? So it just kind of leaves you're already on the path of coding, working around those problems anyway. You're not trying to depend on all those session tricks that the web forms gives us. And then, you know, down in the corner of the architects are like, yes, this is the way we need to build our programs. And the developers are going, just don't make me have to code it and figure out how to do this, right? Is, you know, a real, really nicely layered application where you get what you want out of it. And we've got the same kind of, you know, variety there when you're looking at using services. Right, we've got the self-tracking entities that you can use with WCF. Self-tracking entities are new in Entity Framework. I'm not going to spend any time on them in this presentation. You saw some of that earlier this morning in Steve's talk. So self-tracking entities use a T4 template to create POCOs. Right, they don't inherit from entity objects, so they're already we're taking some of the pain away of working with WCF. They create POCOs that have a lot of very specific logic in them, very, very specific logic. They're really designed to work with WCF. And my only problem with them is that, I mean, just, you know, I code in a different way, right? And I have different kinds of goals. I think that the self-tracking entities are an absolutely perfect entity framework WCF solution for anybody who is coming from data sets and just wants things to essentially work as simply as the world was with data sets and services. When in a scenario where you have your data, you own both sets ends of a wire, right, and you would send your data sets back and forth and just everything would be there and you'd call save and everything would be done, or update or whatever. I've forgotten all of that already, so sad. And the other thing about self-tracking entities is that the client application needs to be aware of them, right? So this is not, you're not going to write this for like services where you expect to have interoperable clients. It's not for that kind of scenario. Your client has to be using Entity Framework 4. It can use Entity Framework 3.5. You just have to, there's just one DLL that changed between 3.5 and 4, and you just have to go reference that one instead of the one from 4.0. And all of those classes, all of that goo and logic and the classes that you generate by the self-tracking entities T4 template has to be in the client application because that's where most of the hard work has gone. Because on the client side, as you're interacting with those entities, the self-tracking entities have all of these behaviors and they will keep track of their information, right? So they keep track of the changes, and then when you serialize them and send them back over to the server, everything that they have all that information about the changes when they get to the server side, and then there's a couple of extra methods that you get also with the self-tracking entities that you can use in the service that knows how to read through them. Does that make sense? So I should pause. Does that make sense? without having to demo it. There's all kinds of great walkthroughs on self-tracking entities you can find with the MSDN blogs and online. And I've got a couple of walkthroughs in the book on them, and I haven't done any videos on them, but there's definitely plenty of content on them out there. So now we're at ADO.NET Data Services, and again, I just want to give you a high level. I'm going to focus on a few things here in code. So I'm going kind of over all these options and giving you a high level idea of them. ADO.NET Data Services I have to change this right here and now. Okay, I feel better. Does anybody understand what I just did? This is a technology that has changed its name a few times. My favorite name for it was Astoria, and then it was ADO.NET Data Services, and now it's called WCF Data Services. So WCF Data Services is a RESTful API, and what it does is rather than having you create your own services with your own operations, and then people have to know what the contract is for your service, right? They need to know what those operations are, what they need to be passing in, what they expect the results to be, right? They have to understand all of that. What the data services do is it essentially takes an entity data model. You could also use Link to SQL, and you can also actually create your own classes just as long as they expose iQueryable. But, you know, kind of like by default, you'd either use a Link to SQL model or an entity data model. You expose the model. So you're not putting your database on the internet so that people can query against it. You're putting an entity data model. So already there's a lot of restrictions there, right? They're going to be querying against the model. And then in the background, the data services will execute queries on the database. And it returns data as in a very specific format. It's called OData. It used to just be the schema that WCF Data Services returned. But now they've actually kind of codified that. They've made it's a specification how that data looks. So a lot of people now can, if you create services, however you create them, with WCF Data Services or something else, that return that kind of data that looks like that, then anybody knowing that it's that specification will know how to consume that data. So people can query against the model and get that data, and you can put all kinds of restrictions in there and what you expose, a bunch of customization you can do with it. But you're not really writing, you can customize it a little bit, but you're not the service itself, but you're not really writing services, and you're not writing entity framework code in there, right? You're creating a model and you're exposing it and maybe, you know, doing some configurations to it. So to me, it's an important thing to be aware of. It's not really about entity framework programming, though. Does that make sense? It leverages entity framework behind the scenes, absolutely, but you're not in there figuring out how to move the things across the wire and how to deal with the change tracking. It takes care of all that for you. There are a whole bunch of client APIs for consuming that data. Okay, and then WCF Data Services, through its RESTful API, you just make calls, web calls like put, get, delete, right, in a URL. Or in JSON, or using one of the client APIs. And WCF Data Services takes care of all of the change tracking and the updates and inserts and deletes. So it does all that for you. So you don't have to make the kinds of decisions about things that I want to show you today. You don't have to make those kinds of decisions when you're using WCF Data Services. Those challenges are essentially gone. Okay? So what we have left that I want to focus on are using MVC, using WCF when you're writing your own services, and building ASP.NET applications, and solving some of these problems we were talking about, you were listening, I was talking, and and taking advantage of a lot of the new stuff in Entity Framework. So most of the things, all of the things that are going to help are things that you've seen already today. Thanks in great part to Steve. Thank you, Steve, for making this easier for me. One of them is foreign keys. And I found I'll show you something that when I was rewriting an application from the first book to the second book, I stripped out so much of this kind of workaround hack code that I had to write in there to make things work the way I wanted to. And foreign keys were a huge help for me in a web forms application. So I'm going to show you that. But you'll see from that demo, hopefully you'll see like a bigger picture of all the places where all the kinds of ways the foreign keys can really help when we're doing disconnected applications. The next thing, which is really, really big, is those new state methods. And Steve talked about them. We'll take a look at them. One of them is actually a renamed method that existed in Entity Framework 3.5, which is it's apply current values now, and it was apply property changes or something like that. So the most important one really in here for me is the change state, and we'll focus on that. All right, and it'll be easier to show you in code why it's really helpful. The fact that we have the POCO classes in the T4, when I show you my WCF, you'll see I really take advantage of a lot of that. And self-tracking entities, again, I'm not going to be showing, is, you know, in the list of some of the things that they've done. That's a huge thing that Microsoft has done to make dealing with self-CF a lot easier. Now, they're not called WCF self-tracking entities or self-tracking entities for WCF, but they were really written with WCF in mind. And some of their important behavior is dependent on the WCF serialization. But I know that, I was poking the team about this because when I first saw self-tracking entities, I was like, oh, I'll be able to use them for, you know, all this different stuff, right? And they're like, well, we kind of wrote them for WCF. So I talked to them about, you know, the different things I want to do, like it'd be great to use them in web applications, right? Maybe to do some caching, maybe to do to be able to set up some kind of internal caching so you can do rollbacks really easily, because you can't roll back a context. Once the Entity Framework has made modifications to an object state entry, you can't roll it back and say, oh, I want to undo those changes, right? So I was thinking you might be able to really take advantage of that stuff. So these are some of the things that are really useful in there. And so I'm just going to... My hope is to concept, and then go to code, okay, instead of going back and forth. I really just want to code. Oh, goody, it's time for code. I'll talk about these things as I'm showing you the code, okay, I promise. But that was a cute slide, right? No? You guys are tired. Should I play some more music, turn off the lights? Chocolate, what do you need? Dance? A Victoria's Secret runway model walking by a couple of times? All right, so first thing I want to do is show you, I'm going to open up a web forms application. And this has in it, I'm not doing what I want to do here. I think the live meeting client is slowing my computer down. What do you think? Will we be editing the live meeting to, like, you know, cut out this? Wait. Jeez, what is going on here? I'm going to pass around a hat to take a fund for a new laptop, a fund collection for a new laptop, I think. Okay, so this is a really, really simplistic way of looking at how the foreign keys can have a really big impact when you're working in a disconnected way, okay? So I have a little web form. It's really simple. I have a list. It will show, actually, just run the darn thing. It has it's for like a conference, right? I have a list of rooms that are being used for the conference, and then we can click on the rooms and see what talks are in each room. And then I'm able to add new talks for the rooms. Something is really clogging up my computer. That is not it, but I'm just going to shut down everything I'm not using. Okay. I was like, oh no, I shut down the live meeting. All right, do I have a break point in here? I must. Just keep clicking around until I find what I'm looking for. Yeah, it is. It's just weird. You expect the break point to kind of like pop up and be right there. Okay. Oh, remember I said that the big bubbles, and I said I'll come to them when I hit them rather than discuss them. So here's a really important thing to be aware of. Now we're going off the foreign keys. Really, really important pattern to be aware of when you're working in a disconnected environment. Do not return queries to your client. All right, I actually don't even return queries to local clients. Like if I'm in a WPF app or a Windows app, it's not my habit. Here's why I don't return queries, and across a server, it's really important. A query's job is to be executed. In other words, a query's job is to, you know, create a query and execute a command against the server, right, and bring back data. A query's job is to be executed. Now, if I have a server-side application, I've got my nice server code where I have an object context, and I create a query and I define it, you know, from or context dot breweries, right? Return context dot breweries. And, you know, maybe I'll say it, I'll express it more like a query, from B in context dot breweries, select B, right? So there's a query. So take that query and I return the query across the wire, right? So now I'm on the client side. And essentially, I'm no longer part of Entity Object, Entity Framework, and the markup is trying to generate, like, especially if I'm disconnected, I'm in a totally different class. The problem is, depending on the way you're architecting it, there's a lot of places where you're going to be trying to execute a query, but the context that the query was built on is no longer in memory. The query is unable to do its job. Does that make sense? You could specifically be really careful about how you're designing your application so that you don't run into that problem. But it's a really common scenario people get into, especially when they start writing applications where they're breaking their logic apart, right? So you have something like a repository, right? And then you're instantiating the repository, returning a query from the repository, and then the repository goes out of scope, goes out of memory, and then you've got this query, and you try to execute it, and there's no context anymore to execute the query. That makes sense, that problem, right? So I just avoid it totally, right? That's my practice. I completely avoid it. I don't pass queries around unless I'm doing something very specific where I'm working with queries, and I explicitly know that that's what I'm doing. I want the query. I don't want the object instances returned from the database. I really do want the query. So that would be the one time I would be doing it differently. But for the most part, what I do is I execute it before I return the data. Okay? So I'm returning objects. I'm not returning queries. So there's a lot of ways to execute it. I mentioned this earlier today. Just doing something that says, I want the data now, right? Whether, you know, whether you call to list or execute, there's a lot of ways of doing it. I just use this as my default way of executing queries. Yep. If I was using lazy loading navigation properties, that could be a problem too, depending on how, when you're binding, depending on how separate your layers are. If the context is not there anymore, lazy loading can't do its job either. Okay? I mean, there are plenty of scenarios where it'll just work based, you know, if you've designed it in a certain way. But like I said, I just avoid it. But then I'm really careful and thoughtful about where I use lazy loading. I don't just use it by default because it's there. I'm very conscious about when I'm calling, when it's being used, when my database is being hit, what's going on in my database, you know, profiling my application, profiling my database. I'm really, really explicit about doing that. And I think everybody should be, by the way. Thank you. Yeah. There's a question about passing the query. Why don't I like to pass the query?
No, you said passing the query. I don't know.
Oh, that's a really good question. The question is, what do I mean by passing the query? I mean, rather than executing the query, returning, this won't compile because I'm saying, I can actually do this. I can do this. Here, this is, well, this is an object set, and an object set inherits from object query, right? So this is also a query. It looks more like a query if I said from R, oh my gosh, in context.rooms select R. Okay, so what I'm doing now, I'm binding the data source literally to a query. This is a query, not a collection of objects, not a list of objects. It's just a query. It's just a query. Might be easier if I do this and then try to run my demo. And I'll be like, what did I do? Okay, so this query itself, this is just an iQueryable now. It's a query. It's not my actual objects. So it hasn't been executed yet. I haven't hit the database yet. Okay? At some point down the wire, when ASP.NET starts to build the markup for this list box, that's when it's going to go, oh, I need that data. And then the query will get executed. How can you pass the query over the wire? Well, it's an iQueryable. So if your client says, you know, I'm expecting an iQueryable, then I can return an iQueryable. But I'm not returning the actual objects, my actual room instances. So you can pass it across. So here's how people use it. A lot of times, and you can, this works in a lot of scenarios. Like I said, it is my practice, and I just want to share that because there's a lot of places, the way I write code, there's a lot of places where it just won't work. You know, I don't pass it around that way. But here's exactly, you know, a scenario where it works. A data source, a list box data source, does accept an iQueryable as its data source. You know, you can set that as a data source. And then as the markup is being generated, that my entity framework is working, I'm still on the server side, right? I'm not in the browser. I'm still on the server. It will still work here. So I'm not saying this is going to break. I'm saying this is my habit because there's a lot of scenarios, the way I architect my applications, where it doesn't work. But I'm still, in this context, I'm still in Entity Framework. I'm still on the server side. I'm still getting an object context. And I think this is important. That's why I'm dwelling on it. I still have an object context. And so when the page gets to the point where it's trying to generate that markup for the list box and it says, hey, you're a query, do whatever it is that you do to get me the data because I don't care about a query, I need the data, it will get executed. I'm going around in circles, and I can see by your face it's not working. All right, let's talk about that when we get to the services because it may make more sense. Because the problem is this code I'm showing you, it works.
You know, I was thinking about converting that string to
iQuery
and then.
I will walk through a WCF service. Okay. So I don't want to return. So I'm just pointing it out here, even though in this scenario, it's not literally a problem. But I just always do it that way so I don't run into the problem when I'm in a different scenario. In this scenario, it will actually work because I'm just coding in the code behind. So let's get to the real problem here, which is after we're talking about the foreign keys. Oh, my God, look what time it is. That's okay. There's a whole demo I can't do. So it does work, you know, it would work even if I just did the query in this particular situation. So here's what I can do. I can select room A, I can select room B, right? So I'm going to go to room A, and I'm going to add a new talk title, disconnected, EF, 3 p.m., okay? And I will click my button, and in my code behind, I've only written half the code here so I can show you what the problem is. In my code behind, what I want to do is now create a new instance of that talk and join it to the room, right? So that room is now aware of the talk, and then call save changes. All right, so that makes sense, right? There's only one problem. Well, so far, I don't have any code in here about a room, all right? So here's the problem that was a real pain in the rear end to solve in Entity Framework 3.5, and it's really, really easy to do in Entity Framework 4. I still need to assign the room ID. That's what I haven't done yet. I haven't added that code in there. I need to assign the room. In Entity Framework 3.5, when I did not have a foreign key, my only opportunity would be to I want to go a little further there. It's to say room equals, now I have a problem. I don't have a room object, right? My room object just doesn't exist. I did bind a whole bunch of room objects to that list source, but now I've done a postback. I don't have those objects anymore. All I have is a bunch of markup. I have, and my list source, what I did was I bound the IDs and the names to it. Now, in Entity Framework 3.5, I wouldn't have even done it this way. I would have just bound the objects. I didn't. Oh, no, that's not true. Rewind. Okay, just forget I said that. So I bound. I have the list of rooms, and I bound the list of rooms to this list box. And I said, you know, my key field is ID, and I want you to display the name. All right, but when I get back here, when I post back, all I have is that list, so I can't say make the room equal to room, or, you know, somehow room ID equals room ID. I just don't have access to those room objects anymore from the list box, right? All I have is a list of, you know, kind of an array of ID name, ID name, ID name, ID name. Yeah. Well, they're not. Not even a question. It's a statement. The entity objects wouldn't be on the form anyway. This is not a new problem, right? This is nothing new. You have the same thing with data sets. You have the same thing with entity, any object that you use, entity object or otherwise. But the problem was that we got when we got to here, entity framework forces you to do your to make your reference by saying you need to put a room instance, my room instance. It's the only way you could identify that. You had to set a room instance because it didn't expose foreign keys. That's the point. I mean, it's stupid simple, and it only is of interest to people who struggled with this, with .NET 3.5, right? Because really, it's just stupid simple. All we have to do is say room ID equals, and guess what? Now, you know, we have that ID we can use. And I did myself a favor because I didn't think I would remember this time of day. Thank you. Right, I can get the selected value from the list box, convert it to an int, and just set it here. Right, so it's no big deal at all, right? If you're starting with entity framework for it's like, well, duh, yeah. This is exactly the way it should work. No, you know, why did we just spend all this time on it? And it's because I just wanted to make sure that the people who, if anybody struggled with this in .NET 3.5, right, this is a huge thing that Entity Framework does. And it's not even that. I know people who are using Entity Framework just starting with 4, and they are, you know, they're so focused on the, you know, talk.room equals room instance that they're doing that, and they don't stop and back up and think, oh, wait a minute, here's a place where I can really take advantage of the foreign key, and I don't have to worry about the rest of it. So Entity Framework doesn't need it doesn't need to have the ID and the room instance. There's sometimes where you'll have both. You'll have availability to both, and you can set pick whichever one you want to set, which makes more sense for your business logic. But so this is a, like I said, a stupid, simple view of this, but there's going to be a lot of places where you'll be able to take advantage of having that ID, that foreign key, and just be thinking about that. And there are people who still, even though we can use foreign keys, still may not want foreign keys in their applications, right, in their domains, in their models. They just may not want to use foreign keys. I know there are people who just don't, you know, they're like, well, we have the relationships, I don't need them. But you're going to get back into this problem here. So the foreign keys actually is a huge boon for me when I'm doing disconnected applications because I do have access to that when I don't always have access to the objects. All right, so moving on, because the more interesting thing to me is the WCF. Who's building services here? A handful of people. Who's doing MVC? Smaller handful of people. Okay, so I want to move on to a WCF service. And I have a shortcut to it for a reason. Okay, so in this WCF service, I'm actually taking advantage of a lot of these other things I talked about with the fact that you can change the state. You can actually say this is exactly the state I want it to be. You couldn't do this in any framework 3.5. We're going to take advantage of the POCOs. We're going to take advantage of the T4 customization. Really, as somebody who does a lot of with services, I'm really, really, really happy with the things that I have an entity framework for that allow me to do architect things this way, build things this way instead. So I have a number of projects in this solution. Okay, the first one I want to show you is, I'll show you the model. And it's just that breakaway model, the one that comes from my book and that Steve showed you earlier. And it's not even, you know, like, who cares? It's just a model we're going to use to show this. And I am using a modified version of the POCO template that you can get online. All right, and I'll show you what's modified. I don't believe I've done anything to affect the context, so there's nothing new in there. Oops, I don't really care to show the template. So the context is kind of the default context that you get with a POCO template. So I haven't really done anything special there at all. Double check. Okay, so here's a bunch of things. First of all, I've turned the lazy loading off. Remember when somebody asked already about serializing and lazy loading and the dynamic proxies, and I said, I have to turn lazy loading off all the time anyway. And you understand, as an object's getting serialized, the serializer is touching those navigation properties. And remember, even the debugger triggered the lazy loading. So the serialization will also trigger the lazy loading as it's just trying to serialize that property and go, oh, guess I better go back. So that's a really big problem. So since I'm building these entities specifically for WCF, I'm just turning the lazy loading off. And if I do need to use it just on the server side, I'll just explicitly load. You know, I'll just make my own calls. I don't need to have lazy loading there. I'm fine with that. So that's why you saw the lazy loading is off here. So the template read that model and set it to false here. So I haven't changed the context template. I made some changes to this project I have the context template and the model. Now I have my entities and the template for the entities in a separate project. There's a couple of ways to set this up because when you originally download that, have that POCO template and you say, okay, I want to do code generation with this, it puts both templates, both of those TT files, into the same project with a model, right? So this is different. I pulled that TT file out into a separate project so that I can have those separate, so I don't have to have all this stuff together. That's the way I want to have that happen. There's two different ways to do this, it's in the book, but I just want you to understand, I like to make $1.50 every time a book is sold. So when I say it's in the book, it's not like I'm trying to get rich making you all buy copies of my book. I'm just saying, you know, I wrote extensively about it. But there's also some great blog posts right on the ADO.net team's blog, explicitly show, very, very clear walkthroughs on how to get this separation so you can put your entities into a separate project, okay? So I've already done that. I'm not going to walk through how I did that, but that's how they're in a different place. But the more important thing is that I made some modifications to the template. I'm actually probably not going to spend time looking at the template itself. Let's look at one of the classes. I made some modifications to the template so that my classes that are generated are a little different. One of the important things is I removed the code in the template that marks my properties as virtual. So essentially, I didn't really need to turn the lazy loading off because I'm not going to get it anyway, right? But I did. I was just covering all of my bases, okay? So that's one of the things that I did. You'll have access to this project after this day. It's not going to be like at 6 o'clock tonight, but over the next couple of days, we're going to put the slides and all the demos up online. I'm going to send an email to everybody like I did in advance through Eventbrite saying where all that stuff is. Peter Laudetti, we'll all have pointers on our blogs and everything, so you'll be able to find it. And so you can take a closer look at this template, okay, and the modifications I made to it. There was something bothering me here because I was about to say, and another thing I did, and I wasn't seeing evidence of it here, And here's the reason I wasn't seeing evidence. I happened to open up a customer which inherits from contact. Okay? Contact is another one of the entities. I build inheritance into this model. I build a lot of stuff in that model. Let's open up contact so we get something that isn't inheriting from another entity. Here's what I wanted you to see. Using the template, I instructed it to make sure that all of my classes, except for classes that inherit from another class in the entity, that my classes inherit from my own class called state object. Let's take a quick look at state object. State object gives me a state property. Bless you. With a whole bunch of enums. And there's a little helper class here. But let's focus on the state property and the enums. What this means is all of my entities now have their own little state object. Okay, so think about all that you've learned today about the context and entities and their state. The object context keeps track of an entity state inside of the object state entries. The entities don't know anything about their state. So in a WCF application, create some entities, send them across the client. The client makes some changes and sends them back. We get the entities back. All we know is they have values. We have no way of knowing for sure that this one was modified, this one was inserted, what field was, you know, the modified one, which field was modified, right? We don't know any of that stuff. So you have to do stuff like, oh, well, the ID is zero, so maybe let's hope that that means this is new, and I'm going to do an insert. And cross my fingers that that's a good assumption to make, right? With the modified ones, let's see. Well, the ID isn't zero, so it's either unchanged or maybe there was a change to it. So I'll just go ahead and do updates on every single field in those just in case, right? What about if somebody deletes an entity on the client side? It doesn't come back. You have no idea that it was deleted, right? There's no entity for you to read to say, oh, this was deleted. I'm going to have to send a delete command to the database. There's no way for you to know any of that information. And there's a lot of crazy code we had to write in .NET 3.5 to kind of get around all of that. So now what I'm doing, thanks to the fact that I can do the POCOs and I can modify this template. It's really easy to do changes. I'm going to just have a state property. That's all that I'm going to get from here is the property that says .state. I'll have a state property in each of these classes. So now anybody consuming my service, they do have to follow a contract. And the contract is you are responsible, you the consumer of my service, are responsible for maintaining that state property. If you do that, then when you send your data back to my service, I'll do the right thing. I'll update anything that needs to be updated, I'll make deletions. Oh, the other part of the contract is you can't just, if you want something deleted, don't delete it. Just mark its state as deleted. Does that make sense? And I could not do that before unless I'll tell you what I did before. I created my own little classes, DTOs, data transfer objects, really, really simple classes, and I put a state property in each one of those classes. Then on the server side, I had to write a query, and then I had to take the entity objects that came back in my query and push all of that data into DTOs, right? That was 90% of the code. Well, no, that was 45% of the code in my application. Then I send them down the wire, the person does the work, they send back the DTOs, and the other 45% of the code in my application, which is a huge amount, you know, I may be exaggerating, was converting the DTOs back to entity objects, dealing with relationships, doing all that kind of stuff. It was awful. And I had to write, that's why the first book was so long. The second book was long because there were so many new things. It was a real pain. So now I just have this in there through CodeGen, and I don't have to do the DTOs. I have that. So that's another really important thing that I'm taking advantage of. Now, what I'll do for the rest is there's a whole bunch of stuff I'm doing in the services I think what I'm going to do is I've got a little console app that just hits the services so we can see how all this is working. So we'll step through the code, and when we get into the operations and the services, I'll highlight some of the other things that I'm taking advantage of for this pattern. Does that sound good? Yes, if it gets us closer to the end of the day. Sounds great to me. All right, so here's a little console app with all my breakpoints in it. You know, the console app has a reference to this service, so it knows how to communicate with my service. My service has just some really kind of simple CRUD operations. I should probably just at least show you that. I'm not going to walk through all the little things, though. As a matter of fact, well, here's the interface. I have a method to get a list of customers. Okay, just a quick list of just the names and IDs of the customers, right, because I'm building an application where somebody will have a drop-down list. And the goal of what this is supporting is I'm going to get a customer. It lets me assign customers to trips that are upcoming, so for making reservations. So I have customers. I can get a list of trips that are upcoming, and then I can create new reservations based on those trips and add them to a customer and save them. So that's what it'll be, what this is set up for. So, you know, some basic CRUD, get a customer, when I send in a customer ID, save a customer, so I'll pass in the customer back from the consumer, and then these lists that I need to interact with. Okay, so the first thing is just getting the customer pick list. And here's probably where I should have stopped and talked about not returning the query instead of talking about it in the web app, in the little dumb code behind drag and drop web application where the point didn't really come home too much. But here, across the service, I'm executing the query and returning a list of entities. I'm not returning the query. So that's extra important in the services, and we've already gone over all that. Now, you saw with what I did, I'm not using dynamic proxies here, but I just put a note in here. This is for, you know, you download it and you forget this part of the day. There's just an explanation of that important note to remember about, you know, I'm not using the dynamic proxies, but if you were, you'd have to turn those things off. So I'm just returning that list. Come on. I was hitting Shift F11, but those breakpoints kept getting me. Okay, so there's my list. And then I'm going to pretend, you know, somebody's using user interface and they drop down the list and they just happen to pick one of the customers, the eighth one. And I'm going to grab the ID as if the UI grabbed the ID from a drop down list or whatever. And now I'm just going to make another call to the service to bring back the specific customer. Okay, so I'm passing in the ID. And on this side, it's nothing. Nothing interesting happening in here at all. I'm just doing a query and executing it in a way that I'm this execution is saying, just bring me back the one item that I expect. Okay? There's a bunch of ways to do that to get one item. There's first or default. These are not specific to link to entities. These are in link. First or default, so if you're querying against something, there might be 10 things that satisfy a where predicate. Just give me back the first one of them, right? Single or singular default. Single just says I'm expecting only one, so bring back only one. And if you call single and there could be, you know, if you say where last name equals Smith and there's 100 Smiths in there and you say single, you'll actually get an exception because it writes itself in a way that it only knows how to deal with one possible thing in there. And that all happens on the server side, that it's not going to bring back all 100 and then give you the one. It creates the query so that you only get the one. And then if you add or default, these are important things to understand. If you add or default and it doesn't find anything, there were no results, you'll get nothing back. But if you just call single instead of single or default, or first instead of first or default, and there were no results, you'll get an exception because it's going to it won't even know how to deal with null. Okay. Kind of thing. I would have if all day was just the first session, I would have probably gotten into that. Anyway, so other than that, nothing interesting happening here. So I'm going to make a change, and I'm subscribing to this contract, right? In other words, like, you know, I verbally said, yes, I'll do all those things. So I must change the state. Remember, I defined those enums, so those enums got serialized, and I have access to using them here, okay? So I can go ahead, and I'm marking that customer's state property, and that state property I have because I'm inheriting from that special class that I created. I wouldn't have had it otherwise. Okay, now I'm going to create a new reservation. And in order, before I can do that, I need to get the list of trips. So again, not a very interesting query. Here are the trips, just a list of 34 possible trips. Creating a new reservation, grabbing a trip, and assigning it to the foreign key. Again, this is interesting. In this scenario, I literally could get away with writing new res.trip equals trips 4, right? I've got the instances right there in my hand. I'm going to have a lot of problems dealing with that when it goes back across the wire, right? And again, that accounted for a whole bunch of extra workaround crazy hack code in my service in .NET 3.5. I'm not going to get into it. But now that I can just set the ID, all of those problems go away. So where you can take advantage of using those foreign keys when you're going across the wire, take advantage of it, because some really weird, unexpected things might happen when you're moving back across the wire and trying to work out these relationships and what's a new – for example, as I – insert, if I create a new reservation and then say reservation.trip equals this trip instance, and then I say context.reservations.add the reservation, the context will go, oh, it's new, and assume everything in that graph is new, and it's going to mark the trip as new, as added. And when it creates the code, that the when you call save changes and it creates all the commands going to the server, it's going to try to insert that trip again. And you're going to, you know, that's not really good either, right? So that was why I had to write all that, you know, all this kind of, you had to undo all that. And you still have to be aware of these problems, and you'll see as we move down, but it's a lot easier to fix for a different reason. Now, I happen to have a timestamp binary field in my reservation class, and you can't serialize. This is just a serialization issue. It has nothing to do with the entity framework, but I have to put a value in there. Otherwise, it won't serialize. Okay, it won't take null. So that's what this is. It's not an entity framework specific thing. I'm putting some data in the reservation. Looking to see where I'm adding the reservation. Okay. Oh, also, while I'm at it, I'm modifying one of the other existing reservations and deleting a reservation, because I have a whole bunch of reservations attached to this one. So I'm doing all kinds of stuff. I'm creating a new reservation, I'm modifying one, and I'm deleting one, okay? So it gets more complicated when you're dealing with a graph than with just a single instance. When you're dealing with the graphs and doing the services and going across the wire and trying to resolve all the stuff on the other side. I'm deleting that. Now I'm taking that new reservation and I'm adding it to the customer's reservations collection. I guess I want to just point something out here. Here, in where I said modified, I didn't bother making the actual modification. I'm like, yeah, we're making a modification. What I care about is showing you that I check that flag that it's modified. So you could pretend I actually changed something in there. The most important thing is I changed the state. So I'm just emulating the change here. And for the deletion, I'm changing the state to deleted. I'm not deleting it, like from memory, so it doesn't exist anymore. I'm marking it as deleted so that we'll be able to do something with it on the other side. So I attach that reservation to the customer so it knows that they're related. But look, I want both of these things. I'm dealing with POCOs. I'm on the client side. I have to explicitly, and I can't remember the problems I had when I was trying to do just one or just the other. And I probably wrote about that in my book when I go over this. And I can't remember exactly what it was. But I actually have to do both of these things. So this is another weird thing, but just something to be aware of. And then finally, marking the state of that new one as added. So again, this is another thing in my contract, right? I'm responsible as the consumer for that state property. Finally, I can take this customer and pass it up the wire to the service to go ahead and update it. And here's the customer. And if we look at, now I'm not attached to the context at all. This is just a plain old simple customer that just came across the wire. It has nothing to do with entity framework at the moment. And here's the reservations. And here's the first one. And its state is in here. It's modified. Here's the second one. Its state is deleted. Here's the third one. Its state is added, right? So they all came across the wire. The customer, I modified the customer, so its state should also be modified. So there's that. So all that information came, really important information came across the wire. I do not need this line of code. Just forget that it's even there. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm creating a new instance. Now, I'm creating a new context instance on every operation where I'm going to, every one of these service operations where I'm going to hit the database. Okay? So I'm not using a long-running context. It's a short-running context. I've got just a brand new one. Every time I'm hitting a new operation, I get a new context. So that's a really important pattern and habit. So I've got a context, and I'm going to take this graph, and I'm going to attach it to my context. And then I want you to see, before I go further, I'm going to open up the Object State Manager and look at what it thinks the state of all of those objects are. Okay? So here's the added entity store, nothing in there. Here's the modified entity store, nothing in there. The deleted entity store and the deleted relationship store, because by deleting the reservation, I also have to delete the relationship between reservation and customer, nothing in there, right? As far as it's concerned, they're all unchanged. Every one of them is unchanged. If I called save changes right now, nothing would happen. Nothing would go to the database, right? But lucky me, I've got those nice little local state properties. So the first thing I'm going to do is, and I should have maybe checked to see what the state is. I know I modified this. So I'm going to go ahead and use this new change object state method to change the customer right here to change its entity state. So to tell the context, I don't want you to think this is unchanged. I want you to think this is modified. That's what I want to do. This is such a nice thing to be able to do. Like, I know what's going on here. Let me have control. And we couldn't do that before, and we can do that now, which is really, really great. So I can just change that to modified. Now I'm going to iterate through the reservations, and I'm using a badly spelled method that is going to look at, actually we'll just look at it once. It's going to look at each reservation, going to look at the local state, the state that I applied on the client side, And then based on that, it's going to give me back what the entity framework state, right? Because I have the local enums, they're not related to the enums of the entity framework. So I'm going to change the state. They match. I made them match, but they're not the same set of enums. So what I'm going to do is say, based on the state that you found that came across the wire, I want to change the object state of the reservation to, you know, what entity framework knows, its state. So modified will become modified, added will become added, et cetera. So if I run this up to the safe changes and I go back and look at the object state manager and open, go down here, unchanged is down to 4. Modified is 2. That's one customer and one reservation. There's my deleted one, and there's an added one in here. And let me just make sure one more thing. Profiler on. Now go ahead and call save changes and just run it to the end. And look at profiler, and there's all the commands that came. And, you know, so if you had done this in .NET 3.5, this is like, oh, my God, it's so much easier. Like, really, really, really. If you've not done .NET 3.5 and you're just looking at for this for the first time, I just want you to know this is the good way to do it, right? This is how you should – this is a really, really good pattern. I've been working on this stuff a lot. There's a really incredibly smart guy at Microsoft, Rowan Miller, and he wrote a blog post where he had essentially come up with the same way of doing this, although he had the get equivalent state flipper, which I really liked. I'm using that also. So I knew that if Rowan had come up with the same pattern, that it was, you know, I was on the right path. This is a really, really good pattern. A question, and then we're going to wrap up and go on to the next session. That's a really, really good question. The question is, am I updating all the fields or just the ones that changed? The answer is I'm updating all the fields. And I had to give in to that. The only way that I could update only the fields that were changed is if I somehow cached the original values or hit the database again and brought back the database values so I can figure out which ones have changed. So I'm not tracking granularly, yeah, I think that came out right, all of the properties. I'm just doing the whole kit and caboodle. And that is, it's a really great demo, just not time for it. That is an effect of how the change object state method works, because it just goes through and changes everything. This is what it does. It marks the overall entity state of the object as modified in that example, and then it goes and marks each one of those properties as modified. And that's how an object context figures out how to build the command, right? In a normal case, when you're attached to the context and you're just modifying one field, that one's marked as modified. The object context builds the command based on just that one or two fields that are marked as modified. So what change object state is, it goes through all of the fields and says they're all modified. And I really fought that because I was like, but it's inefficient. I'm sending too much information. I don't need unnecessary information to the database. Right. That's what I'm saying. I'm just not doing that in such a granular way. It really depends. If you've got a huge application with tons of people hitting it all at once and tons and tons and tons of data all at the same time, then it makes sense to make that effort to modify your classes, to make your classes, you know, much more complicated and being able to deal with all of that state. Right, you're like, you know, it's almost like a data set kind of a class. But it makes sense to do that when you get to the point. Well, yes and no. When you get to the point where it matters for performance, that you're not sending all that stuff up, you could do that. Or you can use there are caching mechanisms. But there's a real problem when you talk about caching and you talk about related objects, because how do you know that you've got all the reservations in the cache? In the cache, right? There might be new reservations in the database, so you get into all those kinds of nightmares. So yeah, good question, David.
If your object gets that complicated, then effectively at that point, why don't you just use an entity object, which has all that built in?
I wonder if the self-tracking entities does it to the level of every single property or not. I can't remember off the top of my head. Yeah, I mean, there's a point that you can keep fixing it and writing more code, and yeah, there's a point at which you might say, wow, this is getting to be a lot of work. Maybe I should be using something else. I mean, this is what, you know, a product like IdeaBlade has all solved, right? At that point, you might go, oh, maybe we should just, like, buy something somebody else wrote that does all this for us already, right? There's also another one called Entity Objects. Think another framework. I'm pretty sure that's the name of it. So people have figured all that out. You know, there is a point at which, you know, you're writing all this code, and like, for me, it's fun figuring it out, solving the challenge, right? And, you know, especially if I'm not billing by the hour, you know, it's okay, it's my time, I don't have a deadline, right? Anyway, so I think I'm going to stop with that. That was a lot of information. And give you guys let's say a 5-minute break, and we'll, you know, maybe wrap up like 4:15 or something like that. We'll see how that goes. Okay?